This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Ignoring the warnings. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. And here's what's coming up this hour.
With a nasty spate of tornadoes in the Midwest and now hurricane season officially here, why do some people not see the value in severe weather warnings?
On the personal finance front, does it make sense for a 14-year-old to have her favorite Starbucks coffee delivered?
More Americans are living alone, and that's creating new marketing challenges for companies more familiar with marketing to families.
And to ease the pain of fighting a summons in New York City, officials roll out a traveling court.
And they call them pop-up courts, and the courts have been everywhere from a community center to a hotel, and they've held probably most of them in the offices of city council people.
Wall Street Journal reporter Corinne Ramey on how pop-up courts work and the impressive odds of winning your case. She's here later in the hour. The Toronto Raptors are not the most international team in the NBA. That title belongs to the Dallas Mavericks, who began the season with seven non-U.S. players. But Toronto has been the most aggressive in making multiculturalism central to its identity. If you've watched any part of the NBA Finals in Toronto's games against Golden State, you could see the diversity of fans packed into Scotiabank Arena in Toronto, which is the fourth largest city in North America, by the way. It's a story by Vipal Monga, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He's based in Toronto. Vipal, what have you found?
Toronto is one of the most diverse cities in the world. More than half of the people that are in the city right now were not born in Canada, come from all over the world. It's a pretty great a mix of people that are into this team.
How did Toronto get so diverse, by the way? 50% is a huge stat.
It's huge. I mean, if you think of New York, it's about a third, and even Los Angeles is about 40%, and most of that are, you know, people from Latin America. It's just a very open immigration policy that Canada's had for a long time, and Toronto has, over, you know, as the largest city here, just been attracting people from all over, you know, all over South Asia, a lot of Asians, Chinese people. And it's reflected in the culture in this town. I mean, the food here is tremendous. Mm-hmm. As a New Yorker, I can say that unabashedly, that this food has probably the best, this city has the best food culture in the world.
Wow. So explain the embrace of the Raptors.
Well, this is a bit of a hard luck story. They expanded the team here 24 years ago, for a long time the knock was that people did not want to play for the Raptors. A lot of stars like Vince Carter and Chris Bosh and Tracy McGrady just left because, you know, it was too cold or whatnot. So they think there's a lot of sense of protection of the team here, and for the past few years they've been pretty good, but this year has been pretty spectacular. So I think seeing them do as well after so many years of pain and heartache has really brought out people's love for the team and the city.
How about the organization's effort, I guess, to reflect this, the city's fan base?
Well, I think it's partly the NBA as well. I mean, the NBA, as I outlined my story, has been becoming more international for years now. The basketball has a long, rich international history. I think in the 1930s, the Chinese adopted it as their national sport. As we know, basketball was actually invented by a Canadian in Ontario. So it has the roots, and over the years it's become much more popular in Europe. There's a lot of African players right now, players from China and whatnot, and that's just bled over into the Raptors. They have a Nigerian president. Their coach is from Iowa, but he played in Britain and coached in Belgium for a long time. Players from Africa, and there's even a Canadian on the team. So it's a big mix. And what makes this team different is that they've recognized that, that they can use that as a real selling point. You know, the We the North, their motto, it's like a Game of Thrones kind of like motto, also sort of speaks to that. It's We the North. And, you know, when they flash the motto on the screen, they, you know, flash in 24 different languages just to sort of signal to people that, yeah, you know, we're from here.
That's incredible. We're speaking with Vipal Monga, Wall Street Journal reporter based in Toronto. He's written a piece entitled "The Toronto Raptors Are the North and Everywhere Else." How about the Raptors' success, or perhaps embrace by the fans? What has that meant more broadly to sports in Toronto? Because I normally think of that as a hockey town.
It is still a hockey town, but I think it sort of sends a signal that the sports culture here is changing. A lot of the kids that have come here, you know, again, more than half of them weren't born in Canada, didn't necessarily, or their parents didn't grow up watching hockey, playing hockey. And, you know, often when they come here, it's not that easy for them to get learn how to skate, buy all the equipment that hockey requires, and, you know, it's really tough to even find ice time. So I think it's just easier to play soccer and basketball, and that sort of fed into the fan base of the Raptors. David Stern, the former commissioner, had said when they brought the Raptors to Toronto that they knew it was a hockey town. They wouldn't necessarily compete, but over time what they expected was the kids to really get into basketball, and he was right. I mean, it is happening. I don't think anything's going to replace the Leafs anytime soon, but you can't ignore the Raptors anymore.
I know you said you're from New York, but is it hard not to get caught up in sort of the Raptors' excitement right now?
Yeah, it's intoxicating. I mean, I lived in New York for 20 years, but I went to high school in Toronto, so I have some roots here. And, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. The fans are tremendous. I went to the game on Saturday when they clinched their finals berth against the Milwaukee Bucks, and I've never been in an arena as loud as that. It was like ear-splitting. And they're, you know, it's like unbridled enthusiasm. It's really hard not to just love that. Yeah, I mean, it's been a wild ride, and I just hope it goes on for a while and they win. I think this town would explode if that happened.
Thanks, Vipal. Vipal Monga, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, based in Toronto. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business, but you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Ever wonder if people are talking about you at the office? Turns out they are, and in more ways than one. Here's Megan Greenwell, contributing columnist to the New York Times. Megan, what do you get from readers?
We get questions about everything. Literally, this column has everything from, can I take bananas home from the office kitchen and make banana bread and bring it back to the office, to my boss screwed me over by giving somebody a negative recommendation when I hadn't even been public about looking for a job.
Yeah.
And then somebody figuring out how to leave their job to join the Peace Corps. So it's a wide range, and it's really fun to see everybody's problems.
You know, you open with the situation regarding bananas. You know, it's just not stuff that shows up in the employee handbook, I guess. Explain this person's dilemma.
Yeah, so the question here was, I work in an office, and the office provides free snacks, and recently, the bananas were getting really brown, and as we all know, browning bananas aren't that tasty, but they're perfect for making into banana bread. So the writer's question was, can I take these home, make it into banana bread, and then bring that back and share that bread with the office kitchen in lieu of the bananas that I have taken? And the rationale was, if we had each eaten one of the bananas at work, there would be no problem. So is it a problem if they each eat one banana's worth of my banana bread?
We're speaking with Megan Greenwell, contributing columnist to the New York Times. She's written the Work Friend column this quarter. And it's entitled, At Work, Everyone is, in fact, Talking About You. How about this, the LinkedIn example? This was terrible.
Yeah, this was really tough. So the writer said I was approached via LinkedIn for a new position, and she wasn't really looking for a job, but this one sounded interesting. So she did a few rounds of interviews. She had not said anything at her current job about looking for other work because it hadn't gotten to that point yet where she felt like she was close to an offer. But then she found out that the hiring manager for the new job contacted her current boss to ask about her, and her current boss doesn't like her very much. And so the new employer moved on without her, and she feels betrayed by the organization for contacting her current boss without checking in with her.
All right, is that generally considered a no-no? Like that hiring manager should have asked her permission first to contact the new manager or new potential manager?
I would say absolutely. You know, I run a staff as well, and I can't imagine calling somebody to inquire about a job candidate who I'm not at the point of getting formal references for. That said, I think that industries, and particularly small ones, are really incestuous, and you do sort of have to assume that this is going on all the time, even though on paper it's totally unfair. So my advice for that letter writer was much more about how to, you know, assume this is always going on and try to use it to your advantage rather than, you know, just dwelling on how unfair it is. Because it absolutely is unfair, but it's just not a thing you're going to be able to control in this job or in any job. So if you can try to improve the relationship with your boss, that's great. But also, you know, line up people who will speak well of you in case this boss, you know, does want to trash you further. At least you have people, you know, nobody is unanimously liked, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so if you have more people willing to say you're great to work with than you do people who say you're a pain, then you'll be okay.
Finish up with the situation regarding the Peace Corps.
So this was a young woman who had lost her job very suddenly last fall, and she had applied for the Peace Corps while working in that job. But then she needed a job once she lost hers to be a bridge, you know, for essentially 6 months. So she accepted the job not actually knowing. She had already applied to the Peace Corps, but she didn't know if she had gotten in. Then quickly found out she did get in and is feeling just racked with guilt about the idea that she will be leaving this job so soon for an opportunity that she applied to. I felt really a lot of empathy for her because she's clearly kind of racked with guilt about this.
Thanks, Megan. Megan Greenwell, contributing columnist to the New York Times. It's 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. More Americans than ever are living by themselves these days, and many don't want to bake full-size cakes or buy eggs by the dozen, run half-loaded dishwashers, or store 24 packs of toilet paper. That's got the attention of consumer products companies who are upending generations of product development and marketing that focused on full families. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
More people are living alone and more companies are starting to take notice. As Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal tells us, it's all about individual packaging and smaller appliances. Ellen, how many people are living alone and why is that number growing?
Nearly one-third of all American households are now made up of one person, and that's been steadily rising. The Census Bureau data that I have goes back to 1960, when just about 13% of U.S. households were one person. There's a lot of reasons for this rise. Some of it has to do with delayed or foregone marriage, longer life expectancy, people flocking to cities, and also rising wealth. All of these different factors are contributing to this huge rise.
Now, marketers in the past have taken aim at families of four. Are they just starting to come around to this idea, or has this been a slow change?
It seems as though they're just now coming around to it, that maybe not all Americans live in large suburban homes and need to feed a lot of mouths with, you know, cake mix or a giant washing machine. And as more people move to cities, they're finding that they need different sizes of things. They could use a smaller refrigerator or a dishwasher, or they don't necessarily want to buy an entire carton of eggs, and so they'd rather have an option where they get two eggs in a microwavable cup. There's a lot of different portion size needs that are out there, and it's not always products getting smaller. I talked to a luxury closet designer, for example, and in the 12 years that she's been in business, the number of single clients she has steadily risen, and now it's about 40% of her business. They want bigger closets, and they often splurge on extras like customizable display cases for their handbag collections. She finds that they can be a lot more personal with their choices because they don't have to share that space with anyone else.
Let's talk more about appliances, Ellen. If you live in a small space, you obviously want something smaller, but are there people who live in a regular size house that also want things that are smaller?
I think that that could be. I mean, certainly there's reason to have flexibility in sizes, and I spoke with some executives at Haier, which bought GE appliances, and they were really asking a lot of questions about why is all appliance marketing catered towards suburban houses. Not everyone needs to load every towel they can in from the pool, for example. They don't necessarily need a dishwasher that can wash 12 place settings at once. A lot of kitchens in urban areas are smaller, and they have smaller kitchens, and they don't necessarily want, design-wise, to be overwhelmed by traditional-sized appliances. And so there is a lot of discovery happening about who this consumer is and what they specifically need.
Salad kits is a big one. They seem to be so popular, and that's because there's small amounts of a lot of things in there.
Yes, and so then you don't have to buy an entire package of croutons to make yourself a salad. You don't need to buy large or traditional size bottles of salad dressing that could go stale or old before you have a chance to use it. And so there are product makers, food companies out there who are experimenting with portion sizes and package sizes, realizing that there's different needs out there than there used to be.
Thanks, Ellen. Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, dangerous spending habits for teens. Also, when court comes to you for your summons. And how the NBA's Toronto Raptors are just like us. That story in about 20 minutes. As forecasters across the country try to warn the public about perilous weather events, their message sometimes gets blown away by another powerful force, human nature. You may have seen the YouTube clip recently of a TV meteorologist in Dayton, Ohio, getting annoyed at people ripping him on social media when his station cut into The Bachelorette for a tornado warning. On air, he said their social media complaining was pathetic. What's with this reaction by people on their couches? We're joined now by Jorge Ortiz, staff reporter at USA Today. Jorge, what's up here?
You know, I think there's a part of us that's there. If it's not right in front of us, we get kind of complacent and don't pay that a lot of attention to it. And part of it is, and this is a debated subject, whether there's what they call warning fatigue, where you get the feeling that the authorities are crying wolf. Tornado's coming, and then what it does then is like, why did I have to go in my shelter? Why did I have to miss my show or interrupt my dinner, whatever? Mm-hmm. So, but, these people are doing it for your own good because there is a possibility that tornado will hit you, and you want to be prepared. And the other thing is that the National Weather Service has a difficult job here because they have to balance the not having too many false alarms and getting people complacent with waiting too long to ascertain that there's a tornado coming and then not giving people enough time to prepare. So I think they want to err on the side of caution.
You referenced, too, I think it was a TV station in Atlanta during the Masters when Tiger Woods was making his run, also cut in to that programming to warn about severe weather. And I think it was a female meteorologist in that case got beat up on social media as well. And then you said, you quoted one professor, I think, who said this is fairly common for meteorologists to get clobbered like this.
It is. That's the other thing. So it's like, you know, don't kill the messenger. You know, this person's trying to get bring you valuable information, and this poor woman got death threats.
Wow.
Which is absolutely insane. And both of them kind of spoke out, the woman on social media, and then the male reporter in or male weathercaster in Dayton, he said it on the air. He called people pathetic. He later apologized for that. But it's fully understandable why he would feel that way, because he's doing his job, he's trying to help people stay safe, and he's getting attacked.
We're speaking with Jorge Ortiz, staff reporter at USA Today, and he's written a piece entitled "Tornado Warnings Are Meant to Save Lives. Why Do Some People Roll Their Eyes?" Explain how the sort of chain of communication works when it comes to tornadoes.
So this is something I learned as part of my reporting. You know, the National Weather Service has 122 offices throughout the country, including Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Guam, and they're pretty evenly spread geographically. They're not spread necessarily by areas that might be more hot spots where more severe weather may happen. And so there's a prediction center in Norman, Oklahoma, that puts out forecasts as many as 8 days in advance as to where severe weather could develop. So these offices gather that information, and then they have their own forecasters locally, so they can pay more attention to what's going to be happening close to that area. They have their own radars. They also pay attention to satellite images. So by using all that information, they can make pretty good predictions as to what's going to happen, particularly as you get closer to the date of the event.
Thanks, Jorge. Jorge Ortiz, staff reporter at USA Today. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Are your kids allowed to order food from delivery services like DoorDash? Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements wonders, will they be able to maintain that standard of living when they're on their own if they engage in this type of practice now? He's the editor and founder of HumbleDollar.com and recently had this type of experience with his stepdaughter. Jonathan, explain.
A couple of weeks back, my wife and I took a weekend away and left our 14-year-old stepdaughter with some friends. And when I returned on the Sunday, it just happened I was looking at my bank account, and my stepdaughter, Sarah, has a checking account that's sort of under my name. I'm the custodian for it. And so I just looked at what had been going on with her account, and lo and behold, I saw that $16.47 had been charged to her debit card, and it said it was charged by DoorDash, which is a delivery service. Mm-hmm. So, of course, when Sarah got home, I asked her, you know, what was that $16.47 for? And she said it was money spent to have two specialty drinks from Starbucks delivered to her and her friend. $16.47
Wow.
Paid by two 14-year-olds to have an adult pick up two drinks from Starbucks and have it brought to them.
Part of that rubs you the wrong way because it was an adult who delivered this to two children, right?
Yeah, it is, you know, Gordon, partly the money, but it is also partly the fact that 14-year-olds should not have adults at their beck and call. Now, of course, anybody who's been a parent knows that children assume that their parents are essentially their personal slaves.
Yeah.
But still, I do not believe it is correct for 14-year-olds to have adults running around performing menial tasks on their behalf.
That was funny. So how did you help put this in perspective? I assume you did not lose your mind and go crazy on her. You seem like a very well-mannered guy. How did you have this conversation with her?
So as usual, we had a you know, we always have pretty good conversations at dinner time, and so as you might imagine, that Sunday, this was the subject of our dinner time conversation, and what I was trying to explain, beyond the fact that I didn't think the 14-year-olds should have drinks delivered to them by adults, I explained that, you know, $16.47 in a lot of states, based on the minimum wage, somebody would have to work 2 hours in order to purchase those two drinks. And moreover, in terms of Sarah, that $16.47 was 11 and a half days of her pocket money, and she blew it on two drinks. And I would even venture to guess that she probably didn't even finish the drink.
Yeah. That got you maybe a half hour of what, you know, food satisfaction, I guess, tops?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm ambivalent about this to some degree, right? I mean, as I mentioned in the article for Humble Dollar, you know, we as a society do have a higher standard of living than when I was growing up. You know, over the past 41 years since I was age 15, you know, the per capita GDP in the U.S. has doubled. We are living twice as well as we were 41 years ago, and maybe even that underestimates it when you think about, you know, how much technology has improved our lives and how inexpensive technology has become. You know, arguably we're living more than twice as well as we were 41 years ago.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, editor and founder of HumbleDollar.com. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for being with us. In some cases, New York City will bring a court to you to resolve a case in front of a judge. The traveling court, which can be held in a city councilman's office, for example, is run by New York City's Office of Administrative Trials and Hearings, responsible for handling cases brought by city agencies. Despite a docket of nearly 900,000 cases a year, the court is unknown to many New Yorkers. Faced with relative obscurity, court officials last year launched what they say is the only administrative pop-up court in the U.S. It's a story by Wall Street Journal reporter Corinne Ramey. Corey, set this up.
So this is New York City's Office of Administrative Trials and Hearings, which is technically a city agency, but it's also a court that hears cases brought by city agencies. So that might be the NYPD, the Sanitation Department, the Health Department, and other agencies like that.
So you said this stat was shocking. About 900,000 cases have been heard, yet there aren't many New Yorkers who are even familiar with this.
Yeah, and to be clear, that 900,000, those are cases that are filed. So sometimes people just aren't handling their cases because they think, oh, these are tiny things. This is a $25 fine for not sorting my recyclables, so I'll just ignore it.
So where can cases be heard? You gave an example of one day it was in a New York City councilman's office.
Yeah, so this court, because people don't know about them and they've struggled with this, they have gone on the road, and they call them pop-up courts, and the courts have been everywhere from a community center to a hotel, and they've held probably most of them in the offices of city council people.
And so how do they promote it, if at all?
They send out letters. They give away free tote bags so that you can walk around with your tote bag advertising a court. They've held sort of various outreach events, including at the beach, the swimming pool, places like that.
We're speaking with Corinne Ramey, Wall Street Journal reporter. She's written a piece entitled "A Day in Traveling Court," and it's about how it's almost like a pop-up court. There is a pop-up court that roams around New York City, and helps you resolve some summonses. Also, the odds of winning are pretty good.
They are pretty good. And, you know, most of the cases that I heard, it seems like the people actually won their cases, that if people choose to show up, and most of them don't have lawyers, they represent themselves, but if they have a good defense, say if they bring evidence like cell phone video or pictures to make their case, they seem to do quite well.
And the citizens or users of this court seem to like it?
Well, people who have gone to the pop-ups were full of enthusiasm. They thought it was really fun because they had free cookies, and when I went to, had a cat was sort of getting up in everyone's business, which people loved. I think when people go to the real locations of the court, there's a little less enthusiasm because sometimes the wait is long.
Thanks, Corey. Wall Street Journal reporter Corinne Ramey. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Airline passengers preparing to leave Canada from Toronto Pearson International Airport one recent afternoon were not expecting to lay eyes on the country's current hottest attraction, and that's the Toronto Raptors. Players were navigating the airport chaos like ordinary civilians. Fred VanVleet was schlepping his own luggage. Norman Powell was waiting in line at Starbucks. The Raptors were on their way to the charter jet that would take them to their next game. The Wall Street Journal says in every other NBA city, that would mean being whisked onto a waiting plane in a private terminal. But traveling from Toronto to the U.S., the law requires them to clear border security first. The airport drill is one of the regular irregularities that come with playing for the only NBA team outside the U.S. Every time they cross the border, the Raptors have to travel like normal people. They must clear security and customs, make their way through the scented world of duty-free shopping, and drag their carry-ons over the airport carpeting. Game 5, by the way, between the Raptors and Warriors is Monday, back in Toronto. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.